Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
4 people in each blind. All of us past presidents. There was one or two that didn't make it. 0 shots.
Zero shots.
Really?
I have never seen that there. You know, I go, hey, it's nice to see it happens to somebody else. I
mean, yeah.
There were 3 blinds had 0 shots.
Wow.
And 1 blind got 2 birds.
Was that during that big cold snap too?
No.
Okay.
I don't know if it was after or before. But, no, it was before. But I think the cold snap was up north.
Oh, okay.
We didn't even see. I saw 2 mallards, maybe a couple of wood ducks.
No kidding.
And they never even thought about coming.
Did they say what the reason was? They thought were all the
no,
birds.
No, it was just everything was dispersed. Mm. Same thing.
Did they have a bunch of water over there?
Oh yeah, they had water, but it was before the cold snap because the birds came down. It's just like us here.
Yeah.
You know, the last week of the season was what it should have been the first week of December.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was just nothing. And then it was lights out up at the ranch.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good closer on the college camp this year.
Both of them were good.
Yeah, college camp was great. And I'll tell you what was the best was junior hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Chase was up there with me. And it was just me and Chase. My son and Lily went up skiing, and Chase really wanted to duck hunt, so he came with me. And the Saturday, it was good hunting, and he got birds and everything. I don't even remember what he got, but he did some good stuff. And then Sunday, we were out there until, I don't know, noon or something, and he got 6 mallards and a pintail.
Right on.
And 10 specks.
Wow.
Only shot about 100 rounds. But it was great. He's hooked.
How old is he?
He's 13. He just
like a perfect age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was his 3rd season. First season was college or kids camp.
Yeah.
And he got a bird. I think he got a bird. And the second season, he got, they came up, I think, twice.
Uh-huh.
And then this year, he came 3 times. And he would have come up every weekend if his dad would let him.
Yeah. So he's got the bug now.
Oh, yeah, real bad. And then when we were up there the time before, he hunted with John Vian. And somebody was sitting next to me and asked him. He says, "What do you think you want to do when you grow up?" He says, "Well, I'm really thinking about wildlife management or business. One of the two. We'll combine both of them." You know. So, and he's the one that I would have least expected.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. But They're all having fun. Raylin's liking it too, but her attention span is between an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she goes out there, boom, I got a bird. I got my bird. Let's go.
Yeah, you got one. Check the box. And
no, and Chase is going to be, the 5 stages of hunting. And he's a shooter right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll get going here. Welcome back to another episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. We have a very special guest, Mr. Paul Bonderson Jr., also known as the past president of Ducks Unlimited, also the owner of the famed Bird Haven Ranch up in the Upper Butte Basin. here with Carson Odegaard, and I'm Jeff Smith. Paul, thanks so much for coming on. Known you. I actually started on your property as a wood duck intern in college. So I was working at our summer camps and was doing wood duck boxes. So.
Were you at Davis or were you
No, it was through it was through Chico State. We had it was like the very first trial of that. And I remember it was me and two other friends that were part of the CWA chapter. We're like, oh, go do the wood duck boxes. No one ever showed us to do anything, et cetera. Mac and Dennis were there.
Oh, gosh.
And then they gave us the go around. But yeah, basically it was like every other weekend for, I think, 6 weeks.
Was that where you got into the ringtail? I remember you said you got into one time.
Yeah, it was at Dennis. There was like one box without a predator guard. And it was like the highest one on the ranch. And I was like the very top of the ladder. And it was like the first box I looked at. And I looked at it and it was like, I see his eyes and coming back. And I was like, oh my God, I held the pole and Des was like, what is that? I was like, there's something in there. He's like, oh, it's a ringtail. It's a ringtail. Why don't you come down? He's like, we'll put a predator guard on that. But yeah, like first day on the job, it was just me and him. So it was pretty funny. But
that's neat.
Yeah. So Paul, tell us a little bit about your story. I mean, everyone knows you about Birdhaven Ranch, college camps, youth events, et cetera, philanthropy. You know, how did your story start?
So I'm a third generation Californian. There aren't many of us around, I don't think. I was born in San Luis Obispo and lived there until I was four. And in 1956, we moved up here to Sacramento. And I grew up in North Sacramento and went to Encina High School. It was a nice place then. I guess the area is kind of gone downhill, but it's still, you know, nice area. My father was the executive officer for what was then called the Water Pollution Control Board. And so, which is now the Water Resource Board. And he was the executive officer from 1956 through, I think, 80. And retired in 81. And so he had taken the board from being water pollution only to water quality control. And then from there, they wanted to combine the water rights board with Department of Water Resources, and that was like the fox watching the hen house. So they managed to get it to merge with the Water Quality Control Board, and that's when it became the Water Resource Board. So I grew up with, you know, some of the original conservationists. My dad was responsible for the first bay study, which was a huge thing, and also Tahoe and getting all the sewer stuff shipped out over the over the hill and into Pyramid Lake, I guess. So my first hunting days were with my father was a hunter. His father was not. The whole family came from Dunsmuir, California, up in Northern California. Both sides of my family were with the Southern Pacific. My maternal grandfather was an engineer on the daylight, actually. And my other grandfather was a brakeman. And my great-grandfather on my father's side was the yardmaster at Dunsmuir. So my maternal grandfather got my father into hunting and duck hunting specifically in upland birds. And so at the time, my very first hunt was with my dad and my grandfather up at Tule Lake on Sheepy Ridge.
Oh, yeah.
You were on the ridge?
On the ridge.
Pass shooting.
And I was 8 years old, and at that time, you had to be 12 years old to get a license in California. And so I was sitting there, and I don't think they did a lot of shooting, but what I got into was collecting shotgun shells. And there were red ones and yellow ones and blue ones and green ones and small ones and big ones. And so I actually remember that. And then we were actually refuge rats, and also we belonged to, when I was 12 years old, we started going to District 1000, and you know, they had leases on rice land, and we would go out and pretend to pheasant hunt with we had a Brittany Spaniel at the time. That was a great dog until you took your first shot. She was gun shy, and she would just hide behind.
Yeah,
wasn't so good. but we started duck hunting at Sac Refuge and Gray Lodge, and then gosh, I don't remember how old I was. Sometime probably in high school, my dad and all the other, I don't know if you can say this on the air, you can blank it out. Yeah. All the other shit shovelers, people that yeah. were associated with water quality, had a duck club down the grasslands. It was called the Poco Loco. And it was a very small club. There were 13 members, 13 double tank blinds on 160 acres.
Oh, tight. Oh, wow. That's tight.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, but the good news was that usually there were only three or four blinds that would fill up on a weekend. And the clubhouse was, it was wonderful. It was made out of quarter inch plywood on 2x4s.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And there were bunk rooms, and it got to the point where when myself and my brother-in-law, Dennis, would go down there, we would rather sleep. I would sleep in my 64 Chevy Nova, and he would sleep in his pickup truck, because you got all these, what we thought at the time was the old guys. Now I think they're kind of middle-aged. Yeah. You know, they were in their 70s or 60s, 50s and 60s. But those guys would drink vodka all day long and then, you know, be snoring, and the walls were quarter-inch plywood with no insulation or anything. And so they'd start snoring, and it was just like, it was so loud you couldn't sleep. So we slept out there. Got lots of, you know, spoonies and teal.
Oh, yeah.
And so we had that until, unfortunately, my dad died early on, until 83. And then I didn't, you know, I was raised in a family. My son Rich was born in 81. And so kind of took a hiatus from hunting until he was 12. And okay. then my mom had sold the membership in Poco Loco. So Dennis, my brother-in-law, and I became refuge rats again, and would hunt wherever we could. And I remember, again, Sac Refuge, Gray Lodge, and Dullivan. You mm-hmm. know, if we got drawn at Dullivan, wow.
That's yeah. great.
And so I started taking my son out when he was 12, and had pretty good times at that time. So that was early 90s. And the refuge hunting wasn't bad. And we continued doing that, not a whole lot, you know. We would, I guess, our favorite hunts. What I remember the most was pheasant hunting on the Veterans Hunt at Sac Refuge on Veterans Day,
mm-hmm.
and they would open up the closed zone.
Yeah.
And we would never, we wouldn't even try for a reservation. We had, Dennis had a great dog, and a couple of our other friends that were Dennis's age. There's 4 years older than I am. And so we had three really, really, really good hunting dogs. And Dennis's was a lab, but it was a pointing lab. And so we would go out about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, people would be coming in. And we would just go straight to the berry patches, big, huge mm-hmm. berry patches, and we would surround them. And those dogs were aggressive enough that they would just, it didn't bother them a bit. And I'll tell you, it was just like Vietnam. Because all the pheasants would just go into those berry patches and they would fly out and everybody would get their, you know, get a bird out of that group. And we'd just go to like three different berry patches and we'd be done.
Yeah.
and then again, you know, we'd go hunting a couple of times a year, two, three times a year, until my nephew, Tyson Halls, who is one of our wardens up there at Bird Haven, he became a warden. And when he started hunting, we again attacked the refuges. And he got drawn for Dullivan one morning, and we got out there really early. And by this time, no offense, but, you know, refuge hunting became combat hunting. And we had a real good spot. We were out there before anybody else, claimed our spot. We were, oh, it was terrible. It was that the field that we got in, and I couldn't even tell you which one it was, but it had been disced. And so I'm in terrible shape at this time in my life. And Tyson's like 12. And Dennis was in great shape. And we had a little, you know, decoy boat that you'd drag along. And so Dennis goes out there and takes Tyson out in the boat and drops off the decoys. I guess we had a little island or something. And then he comes back for me, and I hold on to the boat on the outside, and trudge out there. And I get out there, and Dennis is putting the decoys out. And then here comes this guy, and he starts setting up not 50 yards from us, not even 50 yards. And he starts flashing his flashlight at us, saying, "Hey, you," you know, every other word was an F-bomb. "You get out of here. This is my spot. I've been coming here forever." And I said, "We went, no. We were here first. It's free range, you know."
Yeah.
And so he set up there. And again, it's like, here you got this 12-year-old kid, and this guy's just, you know, being an obnoxious person.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that Brocade, the company that I was co-founder of, had gone public maybe a year or two earlier, a year earlier. And so financially, we had gone from being, you know, upper middle class kind of, we had a good life.
Yeah.
And I was an engineer. I am an electrical engineer. I was always in development. And so I looked over at Dennis and I said, "We need to have a duck club." Because what happened after that was we got a bird.
Yeah.
And then everybody in the free range area came over and surrounded us. And we left. And I think it was the following day, I got a realtor. And we started looking for duck clubs.
Up to that point, was that a dream of yours to have a club, or was it more like...
No, it was, you know, Dennis and I and my other brother-in-law, John, we from actually when my father was still alive, the other tradition we had was right after Thanksgiving dinner, or else the next morning, you know, Thanksgiving was usually on a Thursday, we would take off for Tule Lake, and we would go up to Tule Lake and go hunting every year. And it got to the point up at Tule Lake from being a great hunting time to, well, we get a goose or two maybe, to we quit calling it our Tule Lake duck hunt, and it was our Tule Lake horseradish run. We're going to go up and get some horseradish. I remember the last time we were there, we'd stay at the Sheepy Ridge. My dad would rent a travel trailer, and we'd go up to the Sheepy Ridge campground. Yep. And I have a picture of him. The last time we went there, we got one snow goose. Yeah. And I don't even know who got it. Maybe it must have been my dad. Anyway, no, it was not a plan. And we all really enjoyed hunting, especially duck hunting, waterfowl hunting, and upland game hunting. And so I looked over at Dennis and I said, we need to have duck club. And we had the means to go ahead and do that at the time. And actually, when Brocade had gone public, I mean, it was beyond my wildest dreams. It was life changing, actually. And I was always interested in conservation, so it was really conservation and hunting. And maybe at that time it was hunting and conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's conservation and, you know, oh, by the way, there's hunting.
A little bit of hunting too, yeah.
Yeah. And I said, you know, it'd be great to have a duck club. And it was not anything, I had no dreams of Bird Haven being what Bird Haven is today. I had a dream of having a place where the family could go and go duck hunt.
Yeah, you just wanted to go duck hunt and not have the experience you had. It didn't have to be top notch. You just wanted a place to go.
Yeah, and had, you know, again, it's unfortunate that we have gotten to a point where it's combat hunting, because it doesn't need to be that. And again, I'll tell you right up front, I'm an advocate of assigned blinds.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish you guys would push that, because it would eliminate a lot of that, a lot of the problems that we have. But I understand, you know, the refuge guys really want to have free roam, and mm-hmm. so you got to have both. But I'd like to see it go a little more towards.
Yeah, it seems like a lot recently. It seems like that's the way it's progressing. You know,
they took the firing line at SAC, turned that into assigned ponds. Like, that was a good step.
That's great.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and you don't have to have blinds or whatever, but have assigned areas. You know,
I think, quality hunt.
Yeah, you have a quality hunt, because again, had it not been for my, you know, my financial change, we wouldn't be hunters.
Yeah, because of that experience.
Yes, absolutely. Yep,
exactly.
I would not take, you know, by that time, my son was totally into hockey and just about ready to go off to college. And I probably would not duck hunt. I would certainly be upland game hunting,
because
mm-hmm. There's places you can go and have a decent hunt. And we used to, you know, for upland game hunting, you can still do that now. And some of my best hunts were down at, what is it, down there by Paso Robles, Fort Parks or Fort... It's the tank range.
Fort Hunter Liggett?
Yeah, Hunter Liggett. Yeah, that's it. And we would, Dennis and I would go down there every year and go dove hunting, quail hunting. And that was a lot of fun.
Now once you finally did buy, so Birdhaven Ranch is three properties now, that is now Birdhaven Ranch. Like, tell us the process of the first one and then kind of how it snowballed from there.
So after the Dullivan hunt, we got a realtor, and he was not a good realtor. He had an ulterior motive. He really wanted to get me to to purchase what is now the Roosevelt Ranch.
Oh, interesting.
And the only problem was it wasn't for sale. It was the owner was getting on, you know, he was, I guess, terminally ill. And I'm going, no, no, no. And so actually, Birdhaven Ranch is on what was known as the Murdoch Land and Cattle Company. And it was all one ranch.
Oh, okay.
Up until, I don't know, the 60s. And so the Murdoch Land and Cattle Company, you'd have to ask the 4 acres, but I think it was between 6,000 and 8,000 acres all along Butte Creek, which is now, you know, where the 4 acres are with their 3,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all one contiguous ranch from the early 1900s up until the owner, the matriarch of the family, I think, Mary Compton, passed on. She had two children. One of them was a daughter, became the 4 acres, and the other was Bill Johnson. And the ranch was split in half when she died. And the 4 acres still own their whole half. Bill Johnson wanted to get back into the cattle business, and so he started selling it off. So the next ranch we looked at was Casa de Patos, which was owned by Charles Schwab. And I go, oh my gosh, that was 1,550 acres. I go, that's too big. That's too big. And there was already 300 acres of habitat. There was what we call home field now and the South Marsh. But they're not anything, they weren't anything like what we have today. And I thought, oh, that's too big. That's terrible. And so I'm telling this realtor, I'm gonna get rid of you. He said, well, I got one more place that's for sale that you might like. Let's go look at it. Right across the street was where Birdhaven. 640 acres. It was 100% rice. And I go, this is it. And it had a little clubhouse on it. And I go, yeah, this is it. Because again, what motivates me and gets me going is I just love projects. I've been doing projects all my life. And I thought, and I wanted to do some restoration. I had no idea what it was or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we bought that 640 acres. And that's when I started. So prior to this, I had approached Ducks Unlimited because my wife and I decided we wanted to, from a philanthropic standpoint, we wanted to work on number one. Was actually, it's a toss-up between kids at risk and education at the college level. And then third was conservation. So I had approached Ducks Unlimited, and that's where I met Ron Stromstead, who was the director of the Western Region for DU at the time, and my good buddy Fritz Reed. And they got me hook, line, and sinker. And so we ended up buying that 640 acres. And the previous owners to that ranch actually they had the hunting rights. They had the hunting rights on it. Bill Johnson had owned the property. And so I had to buy the hunting rights and the other. And they were looking at doing some restoration, and they had started that with CWA. And so that's how I had the connection with CWA.
Gotcha.
And that was Rob Capriola had done a little plan for what we call the 60 right now. That was our first restoration. And Jake Messerly had just graduated college. And so actually, the first year that we had the ranch, Rob was involved, and then he retired. And so almost everything we did was with Jake and his brother. And there were other people from CWA, but it was pretty much all Jake. Uh-huh. And so then I really, you know, that's 2001, 2002 was the first restoration. I was still working at Brocade. I didn't retire until 2005. And I really started going from my passion being 99% technology and 1% conservation to 99% conservation and maybe 1% technology. So
exciting news. Our hunt program is now accepting applications for spring turkey and pig hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply today. We're also offering free mentor turkey hunts in partnership with the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge. This is an incredible opportunity for new hunters. While you're there, don't miss out on our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets. Some of our upcoming events are the Contra Costa Crab Feed, March 7th, the Wild Game Feed, March 13th, and the Bishop and Dixon Dinners on March 15th. Don't miss out. calwaterfowl.org.
Anyway, it didn't take me very long to figure out what I wanted to do. And again, it was really trying to improve habitat. And again, as you guys know, we've lost 95% of our wetlands in California. And growing up with, you know, my family being totally involved in water, water and conservation, I wanted to bring some of it back. And so it didn't take long to figure out that, oh my gosh, to do what I want to do, I have to have at least 2,000 acres. And so Casa de Patos was still for sale. And so I think it was within a year of buying the 640 acres, we purchased Casa de Patos from Charles Schwab. So that took us up to a little over 2,000. And I'm going, oh, great, this is wonderful. And, I started dreaming. And again, most of this was with Jake, mm-hmm. With advice coming from, my friends at Ducks Unlimited. But, for that kind of project, you know, CWA is actually better than DU. If you want to redo all of the, water conveyance at Gray Lodge, that's a Ducks Unlimited project. If you want to do a 300-acre restoration, CWA is probably better in California. They go a little quicker. But again, I think both organizations are extremely complementary to each other. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I'm major donor in both cases. I'm not even on the board of DU anymore. My retirement was in June of this year at last year's convention. Because you're automatically on the board for two more presidents, 4 years. Once you go from first vice president to president to chairman of the board, and then you're on the board for two more, for 4 years. And then, you know, I'm sure I could still be on the board, but you want to make room for younger people. That's one of the biggest things both organizations need is, you know, we're a bunch of older white guys. We need to get diversified and trying to bring in younger people. So I chose not to stay on the board, but I'm still very active in Ducks Unlimited. Both myself and Al Motna have, I guess unofficially, we are the leaders of the Klamath Initiative and trying to get Tule Lake back to what it was when I was 8 years old. And I think we can do it.
Yeah.
So anyway, but back to Bird Haven. So we bought Casa de Patos, and then the Shepherd family, John Shepherd family. There's a lot of Shepherds up in up in Biggs, and they had 280 acres, which is the northernmost part of Bird Haven Ranch that is surrounded on the west side by Howard Slough and Howard Slough Refuge. And the north side is also Howard Slough Refuge. And they had an opportunity to purchase an area that was contiguous to the major part of their land up north. And so they sold us the 280 acres that was contiguous to the 640 acres. And so that's what Bird Haven is now. And that was all rice.
Okay.
And so, you know, again, the I really wanted to do restoration work. So for the next, oh gosh, I don't know, 5 years or so, we would do, you know, first we did the 60, and then on that original 640 acres, we did another 200 acres the next year. Then we purchased Casa de Patos, and we did some really, really big stuff there, what we call Pop's Place and Nana's Nest. So we did Nana's Nest first, and the reason we chose that, it was right along Howard Slough. It was natural to do. We took, over 300 acres out of rice and back into habitat. And, you know, it was a family operation. We were, Dennis and I and my sister Carla and my wife Sandy, we were out there planting trees with Mac and the original stuff up on the 640 acres. That was that we were out planting sticks, and we learned as we went. And you would have maybe a 50% take on the willow trees, just planting sticks. So what we got, we built ourselves a nursery with every year we would do about 3,000 pots.
Oh, geez. Nice. Yeah. Good little nursery.
15-gallon pots, stick the sticks in there and have drip irrigation on them. Let them grow for a year, and guess what? We start having a 90-95% success rate. And so we would be out there. I'd be in the bobcat with an auger, and I'd go down 8 feet and pull it up. And my wife and I think my wife and Mac would be on the trailer with trees, stick the trees in, then Carlo would come along with a water trailer and a galvanized pipe, and we'd stick it down into that 8-foot hole and fill it up with water. And then, you know, we would do that just before, after all the dirt work was done. And we'd bring up the water and voila. It was really nice. We called it Instant Marsh because along with that, we would get this guy from San Jose that had a 96-inch tree spade. And we had cooperation with Little Dry Creek and Howard Slough Refuges. And by that time, we had some willows growing, and we would put, you know, these, we'd take, 6-inch, you know, 4 to 6-inch trees, take that 96-inch spade and go put them on the islands.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we'd have him work for, you know, we'd get like 20, 30 trees out there along with our little 15-gallon pots. And, again, go over to Little Dry Creek with a 5-yard front loader and get tulies and drop them out there. Boy, within a year, he had a great habitat.
Yeah, you do.
It was a lot of fun. So I love projects. It was, you know, it was about conservation, but it was really about yet again another project to do.
What's the ratio between rice and wetlands?
Well, it's 1,500 acres of wetlands and riparian area, and it's 1,000 acres of rice, but it's actually FSA-wise, it's 953-point-something acres of rice. So it's a good ratio.
Yeah.
Actually, you need both, and it works out real well because either the birds are roosting or feeding in the rice, and then vice versa going into the habitat. And again, this year it was very, very late that the birds started eating in the habitat. I mean, we had smartweed and water grass, gosh, up until the last couple of weeks of January. Then the birds finally started using the smartweed. They were eating there, and so you get the flights between roosting and feeding. Makes you can always have a good hunt at Bird Haven if you know where, you know, if Andy likes you,
if he puts in a good blind or not.
Yeah.
I mean, what are some of the things that you've learned about, you know, owning a piece of property, managing it, that you had no idea that what you're getting into before buying this place?
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot. Again, it's unfortunate that we can't have what I have at Bird Haven in our refuge system. We just don't have the money and the resource to do it. So at Bird Haven, for the habitat, we have 5 full-time employees. We have Andy Atkins, who ran Gray Lodge for years and years, well, for 25 years, 27 years, something like that. So he is a world of knowledge about habitat and our resources. We have Rich Pence, the assistant manager, who worked on the federal side for his entire career at Sac Refuge and Dullivan, and I guess up at Llano Seco. And then we have 3 technicians that have been with us for a long time. And then in addition to that, we work an awful lot with UC Davis. So every year we hire, originally we would hire 2 people to do the wood duck box program. But now we have more research going on at the ranch. So there's at least 5 students, interns, and John Vian, who's doing integrated wetland management, to get his PhD. So there we have him and at least 3 technicians. So now we have like 5 five people there. Total of 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
Our biggest expense is electricity, followed by water,
mm-hmm.
and of course the personnel. So it's you know, I knew it would be expensive, but then again, I'm changing from technology to conservation,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
I mean, again, when we were doing all of this, you know, it's really funny on social media. There was some bad mouthing going on. People thought, oh, here's this rich son of a bitch that's taking government money and doing all this stuff. Not one government cent ever went into Bird Haven back then. As a matter of fact, everything we did, those dollars came back to either CWA or Ducks Unlimited as match money for NACA program, for NACA grants. And now that I see how much Bird Haven is providing to everybody,
yeah,
you know, we have millions and millions of duck days that ranch is providing, that is feeding. You should see the maps of, you know, we have satellite maps of birds that have been released from Bird Haven, and they just go all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so with Andy's expertise, the other thing he knows how to do is get grants. So we work with Audubon and CWA, the rice industry, to get water grants. We're trying to educate them as to the requirements for them, because they're not quite right now. Unfortunately,
you're right.
You know, you want to hold water for 90 days. They want you to put 12 inches of water on it and let it go down. That's not how you make bugs. You know, you want, we're a Mediterranean climate. And what happens in Mediterranean climates, is you get a lot of water and then it goes away, and a lot of water and it goes away. What does that do? That grows bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the shorebirds want. So you don't want deep water. You want water where there's, you know, you've got maybe 2 inches of water, 2 to 4 inches. And it's funny, we've shown the people from Audubon. I guess I should. anyway, you'll see we have two compounds right next to each other. One where we're doing the Mediterranean climate. We never let the water totally go away, but it's low water, and it goes up and down, up and up and down. Thousands of birds over here. Then where we got the funding for water and we're holding it, you know, the water's over 6 inches deep. There's nothing.
Yeah. It's interesting.
And we show them, and you know, it's just that what's happened, and one of the things we're trying to change is bureaucracies are, you know, the environmental scientists are becoming check marks. They're checklist people. And you can't run a wetland with a checklist, you know. April 1st, we're going to put water on it.
Doesn't work like that.
No, you have to go out and be in your habitat. Andy will tell you this. He's out there twice a day looking at what does the habitat need. Does it need water? Does water need to go down? Does it need to go up? Watch the seed production. You don't irrigate on July 1 because it's July 1. You irrigate when the habitat starts getting stressed.
Mm-hmm.
You give it a little water and let it go away.
Yeah, that was the purpose of college camp, to bring those people out there, yes, that are going to be the scientists.
Yes.
At what point, I know you bought this ranch as, you know, a hunting place for you and your family, and now it's turned into so many different things, a classroom, a hunting ranch for you and your family. When did you start bringing folks out there like CWA? Maybe Jeff can talk about this when George was around for these camps. And where did that idea come from?
Well, the college camp, I don't know if we had, did we have kids camp before we had college camp? I think we probably did.
I think we did. It was 1 year, I believe, of the Camp Sprig, and then the following year was both.
What year was that?
That would have been 08?
Yes.
07, 08?
07, 08, somewhere in that time frame.
Yeah, I think 08 was the first college camp.
Again, through probably through more work with Ducks Unlimited. So probably in 2001, again, I wanted to, one of our philanthropic moves was conservation. I was invited to join the Wetland America Trust Board, which is the WAT board, which is the fiduciary arm of Ducks Unlimited. And the WAT board, WAT trustees, manage Ducks Unlimited's land holdings and easement holdings and the endowment. And so at that time, I start really learning about conservation and getting into understanding what's going on, really, really, really making the transition from technology to conservation. And the biggest thing we see as a problem is the younger generations not getting out. You know, again, we've changed from a rural society to very much an urban society. And even during my lifetime, the urban to rural to urban has made a huge transition, and was seeing that kids aren't getting involved like they used to. We're losing hunters, and that's a big problem. So the first thing I said was, I don't know if it was a recommendation from Jake or McClandress, might have been McClandress, to, hey, why don't you have a kids camp? We did have a kids camp. At that same time, I'm really trying to learn about conservation. So who do I meet? I meet John Eady. Who was the Raveling chair at UC Davis. That was Jake's professor. Mm-hmm. He's a waterfowl professor.
Did he introduce you?
Yes. I believe, I don't know how the introduction took place. But then again, in the interest of conservation, now I'm a rice farmer, a gentleman rice farmer. the shepherd, Chuck Shepherd, and actually Bob Bailey was the farmer on the Casa de Cato side, and Chuck Shepherd was our farmer on the Birdhaven side, and unfortunately, Bob passed away, so now all farming is done by Chuck Shepherd. Great farmer. So anyway, I'm getting involved in agriculture and conservation. I go, how do I do this? And I got invited to join the advisory board for the College of Agriculture at UC Davis. So for years, and Bob McClandress was on the advisory board at the same time. So I was on that advisory board for quite a long time. And so I developed a relationship with John Eady, and he was the one that pointed out, he said, you know, I've been doing this a long time. And again, what they're doing is they are training our wildlife management students and waterfowl biology students. And he said that in his earlier days, 90% of his students came from a rural background. They were all hunters. They were all, you know, farm kids. And they understood and came from that kind of background. Well, it had transitioned from being, you know, 95% rural kids to being 95% urban people. And a lot of the urban ones and a lot of our college camp participants, not only are they urban, but they may be, you know, a lot of them are first generation immigrants that have no hunting background or conservation background at all. So he said, you know, we really need to get these students out and show them what conservation is about, get them out into the wetlands, because again, the generations that we have now, everything they know about conservation is coming from social media or, you know, the internet or Walt Disney films. And it's unfortunate. You know, they just don't have the opportunity to get out there. So that's how college camp started. As a matter of fact, there's a YouTube film that CWA put together, and they interview me on there, and I go, John says, I'd like to have a college. Done. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, that is the most, the college camp has oh, I don't know what the word is. It's morphed, you know, it's improved over the years. Uh-huh. And this year we had two college camps. We've now expanded and have a college camp for Humboldt State. Or now I should say Cal Poly.
Yeah, Cal Poly.
That's hard for me being a Cal Poly San Luis Obispo grad. But it is a Cal Poly now, so we treated it such, and it was very, very. Successful. And unfortunately, that was going to be, we've had college camp take over for kids camp. And the reason I did that was the kids that were coming to kids camp, most of them, I'd say the majority of them, were coming from hunting families. And those kids would be hunters regardless. And so again, we only have so many weekends during the hunt season. I felt that we would do much more for the resource by having a second college camp, than, introducing kids, because those kids are going to, they're going to be hunters anyway. And so, I'm real happy that we did that, because the two colleges are extremely different, and as they should be. You know, UC Davis is a big R institute, a big research institute. It's a theoretical college, as it's supposed to be. The state system is more of a practical. And if you look at the kids that... the students, I always want to say kids, they're not, they're young adults. The students that come from UC Davis and the students that come from Humboldt are very different. They're practical versus a little more on the theoretical side. And we need both. You know, again, for me, I'm a successful businessman from the good old Silicon Valley. And it's like anything, you need a diverse group. it's much better than having either all Davis or all Humboldt.
Mm-hmm.
You want somebody to come out and drive a tractor and stuff, get the Humboldt kids. You know, you want somebody to do research on what the wood ducks are eating, get the folks from Davis.
Yeah.
And you, like I said, you need both. You need both in the whole industry, whether it's fish and wildlife or fish and game or CWA or Ducks Unlimited. You need the PhD and you need the BS folks, because you can't do it with either. You need diversity.
Yeah,
really absolutely. Need diversity.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.